Hi, this is Tilo from 3 Talk Truth. Thank you for listening to this episode. We hope you and your loved ones are fine, and we pray for God's provision and protection for you and your loved ones in any possible way. Now, before we will get into this first of two episodes, be advised that this episode includes no swearing, but some graphic language in the context of the topic. So some of the parts might not be suitable for all listeners. But now, to the interview with our good friend, Phil Clark.
And then one of those fighters came over to me and said, you know, we'll come and see you this evening. I think it was 2 days later, suddenly my right-hand Somali came to me and said there was a big problem, and then told me that my guards, all those Somali guards, wanted to execute me. But I remember watching on the TV being announced the United Nations had lost all contact with 1.2 million refugees. I mean, you know, that's really unimaginable. Mm-hmm. So these people just disappeared into the forest, and no one knew where they were.
So hello and welcome to 3 Talk Truth, another special episode from the UK. Now we're in Crewkerne in Philip Clark's family home, and they owned this home for the last 50 years, we learned, and we're privileged to be guests in their home. And we've been good friends with Phil for about 7 years now, and we're happy to have him on our podcast today talking about really deep matters and important issues of our Christian faith. Welcome everyone who's listening, and I'll hand it over to Kim. Kim's here today with us. Last time Hello. It was Bree, and now it's Kim again. And maybe you can just take it over from here.
Sure. We met Phil, as Tilo said, about 7 years ago. We were on a mission trip to Christiania, which is a big hippie commune in Copenhagen. And Phil is currently an elder in a little church there. And that's when we met him. And he invited us to his house, and we were all struck by creepy crawlies everywhere.
Dead creepy crawlies.
And, yes, moths and butterflies displayed, and we were just struck by Phil. The more we got to know him, the more we appreciated his deep intelligence, insight, and great character, and also a man of God. And we've been friends ever since, and he's had some amazing life experiences, and we're very excited to let you hear some of what Phil has to say. So, Phil, tell us the beginnings of your story, how you got to Africa, and we can just let you start.
I suppose I was really touched as a young man, a teenager, by the activities of Bob Geldof to bring relief to the people of Ethiopia during the Great Famine in 1984. And he set up Band Aid, and although there was a lot of hype about it at that time, the suffering of those Ethiopian people really touched me at the time. And I wanted to go and work with refugees and with people in those sort of relief situations. I then went to university, I studied engineering, and at the end of that time, I tried to take up that dream, and I applied to lots of organizations, but I was told that although I had the qualifications of an engineer, they weren't interested in me if I didn't have any experience. Mm. And then through a series of circumstances, my twin brother had gone on expeditions to Ecuador. He was studying environmental science, whereas I studied the boring path of engineering. And I realized from that, in fact, he was having much more fun than I was going on these expeditions. He looked for a bird that hadn't been seen since the 1930s. And I realized I was missing out on something. And then towards the end of my time at university, I saw an advertisement for an expedition to Tanzania. And it was one where you had to pay quite a lot of money. It was with an organization called Frontier. And so I applied to join. And of course, if you could pay, then you could you were allowed to go. And at the time, I had a vintage car. It was a 1932 Jowett Long Saloon. It sounds fantastic, but it was really one of the cheapest makes possible. The brakes hardly worked. And I tried to sell that. And I had this really strange experience when I tried to sell it, that initially I put it on the market for, well, in those days, £1,500. And I eventually actually bartered upwards with the person who came, who just happened to come by the garage one day. And I sold it for £1,750.
Oh, wow.
And then at the same time, I applied for a grant from a foundation which was set up to widen the education of engineers. And I applied for £500 and I got £800. So in both cases, my expenses were covered very, very easily. But also in both cases, there was an increase compared to what I had actually originally applied for. And it was this kind of sign, a first sign to me that that was God trying, you know, providing for me to do that.
Yeah, quick question. Were you a born-again Christian at this point in your life?
I was certainly on the way to it. I mean, I was, my parents were Christians. I come from a line, I'm at least ninth generation of Christians. Wow. In a direct line since the great evangelical revival in England and that happened from the mid-1700s. My great-grandfather was a missionary to Sierra Leone and to the Gambia, then later an Anglican vicar. My grandfather had a very strong conversion experience and was saved miraculously by God at Dunkirk. And then he became the Secretary General to the Scripture Readers Association to the Soldiers and Sailors. And so there was I came from a family mm-hmm. that was strongly Christian. Mm-hmm. And I had an upbringing in the Anglican Church. There were very few other Christians at school when I was, mm-hmm. when I attended. And so there wasn't a very conducive environment. But I remained faithful. I was a regular churchgoer even when I left home. And then when I went to university, I joined one of the Christian societies, in this particular case, the Anglican Society, but became very involved with the Chaplaincy Centre, where all the different Christian groups met. And I got onto the executive committee of the Students' Union representing that Chaplaincy Centre. And so what I discovered in those years was that I can see now it was a calling, but I was in a way directed by God to become involved in the world, but to remain a Christian, if you see what I mean, to become involved in the sort of political side. So going back to going out to Africa, so I went off to Tanzania and worked for 3 months as a volunteer on an expedition. And at the end of that time, I was invited by the organization to become a camp leader. And so I did that for a couple of years. And then even though my education was only as an engineer, I had developed a great interest in the forests, the dry forests of Eastern Africa where I was working, and became the program coordinator of that tropical forest research program.
Mm-hmm. Was that a paid position?
Hardly. I mean, I started off earning £50 a month. And I know we've got a few years of inflation that have gone by then, but even in those days, it was a very small amount. And I ended up, when I became program coordinator, earning £200 a month. But all my other expenses were paid for. Mm-hmm. So I was earning something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But in some ways, it was good that I wasn't earning more, because we would pay a driver in those days about £40 to £50 a month. So my salary was very poor by Western standards, but by local standards, it was
sure.
good.
Mm-hmm.
And but there was a concern. The organization I was working for, I became, as a coordinator, I came to realize just how little of the money that was being paid by the volunteers, including by myself mm-hmm. when I first went out, mm-hmm. actually was being used for program activities that I could see. So I worked out how much was being used on airfares, on insurance, on salaries, and the amount that was given per volunteer when I went out. And there was a huge gap. And at the same time, the owner was educating their children privately, buying a huge house. And I became really quite uncomfortable with that. I was in a way complicit in what I felt was a corrupt, should we say, business practice.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, this would have been towards the end of 1993, I decided I would have to leave because, you know, I was complicit in that arrangement. And at that time, there were a series of massacres in Burundi, which is a country which borders Tanzania to the northwest. And hundreds of thousands of refugees fled into Tanzania. And the owner of the organization that I work for, who was forever trying to cut costs, she decided that we should rent out half the building that we were already renting, we should sublet it to someone so she could save some costs. And that actually meant at a time that there were times when I had to camp on the concrete roof because we had so little space. So it was very much a cost-saving scheme. But in that, anyway, so we needed somebody to move in. And then one evening, we met in a bar, two representatives of the French aid organization, Médecins Sans Frontières. And they had just arrived in the country to set up an office so they could run aid or refugee camps in the northwest of Tanzania. But they needed an office in the capital city in Dar es Salaam to be able to link to all the government officials and so on. And they moved in into our half of the building, the other half of the building, sorry. And suddenly there was this organization of these very dynamic young people with a real purpose, no talk whatsoever of corruption within the organization. And I thought, wow, you know. And then the best thing was they had an administrator who was British and not very able. And I felt that, well, if he could do this job, then so could I. Because I had thought about them, I had been aware of them those years before when I was closing my university studies. But Médecins Sans Frontières in those days, they were the really wild doctors who crawled under the fence, the barbed wire fence, to get into Afghanistan and so on. So, you know, it was beyond my imagination that I could ever work for them. And so I spoke to that administrator and he gave me an address. And then when I left the organization in Tanzania and I returned to the UK, I did try to get a PhD position in Copenhagen and I was actually given a position, but no money. And I saw it as a sign from God that I was good enough, but it wasn't the route that God wanted me to go. So I wrote to Médecins Sans Frontières and they wrote back and said, if I was ever in Brussels, because it was the Brussels office that I wrote to, then I should come by for an interview. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, you know, I've never been to Brussels before in my life, but I would go. I would make sure I was there and then they would give me an interview. And so on a very cold March morning in 1994, I took off and it was before the Channel Tunnel and I took the train to London and over to Harwich and sailed across, probably to Ostend, can't remember now, trained to Brussels, arrived at 6 o'clock in the morning and waited for the office to open and had the interview and I had come back the same night. And then a week later they wrote and said that my profile was good enough. I'd been at that time 3 years in Tanzania, I'd run expeditions, was used to the mechanics of repairing trucks, spoke Swahili. So I had, so it was a good base of knowledge to now, finally. So God used that time as a botanist, as a biologist, to give me the right experience to become an aid worker. And it was March 1994, and I'd been told that Médecins Sans Frontières was now interested in employing me, and then waiting for the telephone calls. With every telephone call that rang, you know, I'd pick up the phone. Is it Médecins Sans Frontières? No. And then the Rwandan genocide broke out, and we had all those terrible stories of massacres and so on. And then I really was nervous when the phone rang. And then it rang, this is Médecins Sans Frontières. And they said, Somalia. I thought, wow, phew, at least it's not Rwanda. So I said, yeah, great. And then an envelope came with briefing about the place and what was going to happen. And the year before, I'd spent mostly in the bush in Tanzania. So I wasn't aware of Black Hawk Down and the American soldiers being dragged through the market of Mogadishu. I mean, I was vaguely aware that there had been a famine a year before and so on. So the papers had arrived and it was a complete shock to me. And it said that I'd be living in this compound and I'd never be able to go out without a military escort. And we had Indian soldiers on our roof guarding us. And then there were sort of requirements. You mustn't be allergic to small arms fire, et cetera, et cetera. And it all looked really quite serious, I have to say. And yet somehow it was still unreal. So off I went to Brussels first and flew then to Nairobi. And I was kind of hoping I'd have a night in a bit of luxury in Nairobi before I went on. But as soon as I landed, I was taken from, in those days, there's a big international airport, Jomo Kenyatta Airport in Nairobi. And then there's a smaller one called Wilson, where the private planes that go off on safaris and actually was also used quite a lot by aid workers. They went from there and I was taken straight to that airport, put on a small plane on my own. And off this small plane went and I sat in the back staring to the back of the head of the pilot. And off he flew. And as you leave that airport in Nairobi, you fly over, and then gradually the civilization ebbs out. You know, initially there's the sort of industrial complexes of Nairobi, and there's just a farmland, and there's just some small farms and bush, and then just thorn trees. And you end up flying for an hour over just thorn trees. And then we arrived at this port city of Kismayu, and there was this huge runway about 4 kilometers long that the Russians had built as a military runway. And as I landed, I suddenly noticed there were these tanks sort of around the airport, and there was sort of a earth perimeter around the whole airfield with barbed wire fence and so on. I thought, my goodness, what's going on here? Then it struck me, it was actually really quite dangerous. And then we landed, and then a Bell helicopter, the types they used in the Vietnam War, a white one with UN painted on it, came down, bop, 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 you know, exactly it's the sound of the Vietnam War. And this really hard-looking guy with crew cut and sunglasses came out, and he said in his deep voice that there'd just been an attack on a UN convoy, and some UN soldiers had been killed, and that's why we'd have to go to the seaport by helicopter. Anyway, that was the guy I was due to replace.
Wow.
So I thought, wow, really, you know, dropped in the deep end there. And then what I've discovered later in my life is very often, the worst is actually often in the beginning. You know, you get, God somehow shocks us with experiences that are so bad that we are actually prepared for what's going to come afterwards. So in that week we had, there was one moment where my right-hand man, who was a Somali on the logistics team, he went amok and held a revolver at some other Somali in our compound, and the Indian soldiers got all upset. And another moment where a Hercules aircraft came with a whole load of cholera infusion to the airport, and we had to rent some trucks, and we went off to the town with these rickety old Somali trucks filled with ragged Somali labourers who looked, well, quite mean and so on. And we went through this town, and every man walking through the streets had a machine gun. And there were these so-called technicals, where you have a pickup truck with an anti-aircraft gun mounted on the back. And we were in a military convoy with two lorries full of Indian soldiers and a big lorry with a huge gun at the back and two jeeps. And so we were quite well protected. But as after we left the town, going out through this sort of thornbush road on the way to the airport, the jeep in charge suddenly stopped, and all the Indian soldiers got out and formed two rings, one with the guns pointing outwards and one with the guns pointing inwards. And there I was in the middle. And then the Indian soldier came up and said there were guns on the lorry, the Somali lorries. And I must say, that was just a moment where I thought, I don't know what to do. But then, you know, I guess it was the Holy Spirit. I had this sort of inspiration to say, well, actually, don't you think it would be better we continue to the airport, because there are more Indian soldiers there, and then we can disarm the lorry there? So if we went. And then there was another incident the next day where we were having lunch and we heard these very loud shots, and one of our Somali doctors had been assassinated outside our gate. So just sort of, it, you know, the taste of the of what it was like in Somalia. And so I did that for, survived that for 7 months, and there were other incidents which were very, very strong. And during that time, we had a moment where the Indian soldiers on our roof were withdrawn, and the UN paid a number of Somalis, who they called police, but really bandits in uniform, who then became our guards. And then you're in this sort of very strange position. I mean, are they your guards guarding you from the vicious people outside, or are they your warders? And they became that, because they came into my office every day with their guns asking for money. And that was very, very difficult to constantly refuse. But during that time, things were working. It was very, very difficult for me. But I developed very much close faith. My faith grew a lot, partly out of need, I suppose. But I think also that contact with the extremely poor. And we had just outside our house, that we had the graveyard for the poor people, the pauper's graveyard, effectively, where the people who we didn't succeed to save in the hospital, they would just be wrapped in a white sheet and buried in there. And it was also the town where the first aid worker was killed during the sort of humanitarian intervention that came as a result of Operation Restore Hope, when the Americans landed and the Marines landed in Somalia. And in a way, that was the first sign of the New World Order after the Cold War, where America would be the world's policeman and would bring hope. But out of that time, the Somalis then became very, very vicious as they saw the Americans as an actor in the war, and their anger was also turned onto the aid workers. So it really was like being in a hornet's nest that had been stirred up. And
could you explain briefly? I'm a little ignorant on this situation. What was happening in Somalia? Why were they fighting?
So they'd had a dictator for many years who'd been supported sometimes by the Americans and sometimes by the Russians. So there was there were huge amounts of weapons in the country. And then at some point, his dictatorship, when the American and Russian support was withdrawn at the end of the Cold War, that dictator lost his superpower support. And then there were other groups that rose up.
I see.
And there was a civil war. But what really made that war different was that the various groups broke into the military armories, and then everybody got a gun.
Okay.
And it became this complete anarchy. There was no government.
Okay.
And still, well, recently a government has reformed, but for decades it was the only country in the world that had no government. And so the Somalis were systematically looting everything, all the government property. I mean, telegraph poles would be cut down and sold to as wood. Government buildings would be broken down brick by brick and sold. It was really a country destroying itself.
In anarchy.
Yeah.
And your role, you had a hospital, or you were just giving aid medically?
So we ran the main hospital in the second biggest city, Kismayu, as Médecins Sans Frontières. And we also had a cholera camp, because the El Tor cholera pandemic had reached Africa by then and was spreading around. So just to give you a little quick background on cholera, it's a disease that comes from India. And by the 50s, it had almost been eradicated worldwide, except in India. But then in the late 80s, early 90s, it reappeared and a new variant spread all around the world. And there were some huge cholera emergencies at that time. So we had that. And we also did things like we brought in the Christoffel Blinden Mission, who did cataract operations and so on. Yeah.
Okay.
And we also had a feeding center for starving people. Yeah. So in this town in Kismayu where we were, the first aid worker, he was called Sean Devereaux. He was a very devout Catholic, and he'd stood up against the warlords and had been executed as a result. And in this town where everyone walked around with a gun, they still needed to pay a professional assassin to kill him. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it showed that these people, you know, they may have had the guns, but it took quite a lot for them to kill a good person in cold blood. That requires a different kind of, coldness than the average person. I mean, many of those others would have shot back if you shot at them, or they shot at someone they didn't like. But somebody who was a decent person, that's normally quite a protection. But there's always people you can hire to do that job for you. So I was very effective. And every day the Indian Army would come with their military escort, and I would go to the security meetings. And on the way, we'd go and collect people from the UNICEF compound. And there we'd always see that was the place where Sean Devereaux had been killed. So it was really quite something, in a way, to be in a place where someone had been martyred. Yeah, so at that time, my faith grew. And there was a moment, I remember, where I was standing on the hospital roof and looking over the hospital area and all the sort of poor people. And something happened. I realized I loved the poor. And then the next day, I was at a security meeting where the leader of the neighboring clan was visiting, and he was there in the UN office, and he was allowed to speak, and it was translated, and he accused all the aid agencies of being against his clan because we were only helping in the town where we were. And I said, well, of course we're not going to help him and his clan when he put anti-tank mines on the helicopter landing pad in his town, which is what was happening. At which point that was translated back to him, and then there was an explosion and all sorts of shouting and that sort of thing happened. And it so happened that the day before we'd had somebody from his clan who'd come to the hospital, apparently with a gunshot wound. And the bullet had just grazed his chest. There was only one hole. And this individual was convinced there was a bullet lodged inside him. And the surgeon, who was a very direct and very experienced German war surgeon, could see it was just a graze, patched him up, sent him off. And he was very offended because he thought the bullet was in there and it would go septic, and therefore that the surgeon had treated him in a way that would kill him. And then he got his militia, and then there was some sort of big threat outside the gate, and the elders had to be called. It was all typical sort of day in Somalia, really. But anyway, the clan leader had heard of this, and then he's shouted out that Maison Sans Frontières was against his clan. And I thought to myself, I must remind myself never to go back to that area, thinking I was safe in the town where I was. And I walked out after the meeting, and there was this sort of battle wagon with this huge anti-aircraft gun in the compound with sort of these rather vicious-looking Somalis with a AK-47 standing around. I thought, gosh, what's going on here? And so I said to my driver, I said, you know, who are these? Oh, he said, that clan has just made friends with the clan who run this town. Because Somalia is split into these clans that fight against each other, and sometimes they align with each other, fight against the others. They have a very unique way of aligning so that you always join the weaker side so that nobody becomes the strongest. So although in a way there's anarchy, there's something very democratic about that anarchy. Mm-hmm. So the warlord who was in charge of the town really had very shaky power over the different people in the town. And then one of those fighters came over to me and said, you know, we're going to come and see you this evening. And I thought, oh. You know, then you go back home, you think, what sort of form of death should I choose? I mean, you know, should I sort of, when they come, am I going to be hiding in the toilet? Or should I just kind of sort of meet them as if, you know, nothing's wrong? So it was a really very tense afternoon, but actually nothing happened. Clearly, I was putting myself in danger. Why didn't I just sort of choose survival and keep my big mouth shut? And it occurred to me even then that the Holy Spirit had kind of stirred within me. The Indian soldiers, they used to patrol the top of our building, and they had a little sandbag turret that used to stand in. But when they left, we didn't really like the idea of these Somalis crawling all over our building when we were asleep at night. So we thought that, you know, it's fine that they were at the gate in another sandbag turret there and so on. But we kind of had an area that we could lock off. But the Indian soldiers had left a sort of open ladderway that they'd used to go up and down. And that became the sort of high place where I used to go up and pray to God up there. And because the city was, you know, completely destroyed, there was absolutely no lights except from our building, but it meant, you know, we had these fantastic starlit evenings. And so that evening, you know, that was the evening after I'd had that feeling of falling in love with the people. I really fell in love with God for the first time. So that was a very strong experience.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And I think it was 2 days later, suddenly my right-hand Somali came to me and said there was a big problem, and then told me that my guards, all those Somali guards, wanted to execute me. So, but that's another story. Lucky I got out of that. So that was another. But I mention it just because quite often we see in our lives that when something happens, we become closer to God, then there's often an attack that comes straight afterwards.
Yes, very true.
And for you, in a very practical way, in a place that is life-threatening,
yeah, absolutely,
which is completely foreign to
that's right,
Kim and I, and maybe most of the people that will listen to this. But when you're in this moment of not just evil, but a threat of death ahead of you, how did you feel? How did you deal with that as a Christian now that you survived this?
In my case, the fact that you survive shows that God's got a plan for you. So in some ways, it strengthens your faith. Because then clearly, you know, because, you know, if God hadn't in some way intervened, I mean, I remember that defense I gave to those police who were all sort of all there with their guns wanted to kill me, who were my own guards. Clearly, I had divine help with that. And then it's very affirming in the sense that you know that there's a reason why you've lived. Because if it hadn't been for God, you know, here but for the grace of God, go I. It's that sort of thought.
What's one of the next steps that took you to starting to write a book about what you experienced.
And there's one incident I want to tell you about that happened in Somalia. So while I was there, the Rwandan genocide was going on. But the Rwandan genocide ended in July 1994. And as a consequence of it, almost 2 million Rwandans actually fled that country, both the majority to Zaire, what was then Zaire, and it's now DR Congo, and the others to Tanzania. And those who fled to DR Congo on the north side of Lake Kivu were all camped on a volcanic plain where there is no water, because water goes straight through volcanic rock and soil. And so they would go down to the edge of Lake Kivu. They suffered quite a lot, but as a result of all of thousands, I think hundreds of thousands, were there on the edge of that lake getting their water, but also some of them, of course, being, or perhaps accidentally, you know, defecating and whatever into that lake. Cholera got into that lake, and suddenly we had, I think, one of the fastest cholera epidemics in the world. And in 2 weeks, 30,000 people died.
Oh my goodness.
And there was this vast humanitarian operation, because during the Rwandan genocide, it had been more or less impossible to come into Rwanda as an aid worker, because it was firstly because it was so dangerous. But here these people were now in Zaire, which was not at war. And the Zairean government saw a great opportunity to make money out of all these aid agencies coming. And it has to be said that a number of aid agencies that hadn't been involved in Africa also saw an opportunity to make money. And it was the big crisis. And there were these images. Mass death triggers people's compassion, but also fear of death. Mm. I mean, I've come to realize since that people, or some people, give because they want to see humanity take control and end mass mortality, because that is a way of combating, in its own way, our own immortality. But anyway, be that as it may, there was 200 aid agencies turned up. It became a bit of what they call a circus. But there were also these people dying in huge numbers. And the world actually ran out of this Ringer's lactate, this cholera, this solution that you use to treat people with cholera. But I had tons of it in my medical store. So I contacted Médecins Sans Frontières and said, listen, you know, I've got huge amounts of this. If the UN or the European community could arrange a flight to come to Kismayu, then, you know, we could fill that plane with this stuff. And it was not just the solution, it was tents, it was cholera beds and so on. And so over the following evenings, I worked really late into the night on my own in that storeroom, cataloguing what we had, weighing it, working out how it would be packed in an aeroplane so to get an even weight and so on. I remember that time thinking that was really the first time in my life I'd really done anything unselfishly, because I didn't need to do it. You know, I had my job and I was doing, you know, what I was needed for the hospital. But here I was having to work extra hours. And I don't know really whether, but in some ways it was a sort of a prophetic action that I did something for that population that I would later sort of be involved with, who at that time were seen also as the perpetrators of the genocide. So it was, I mean, it didn't really occur to me at that time, I suppose, but it was a really quite a merciful act. And that similar population, they had been involved in those massacres in Burundi, which had triggered Médecins Sans Frontières coming to Dar es Salaam. So anyway, I came back from Somalia. I was really quite burnt out. My mother said to me, I was incredibly calm those first few months, except when fireworks went off on Guy Fawkes Night and I was under the table. But I'd had, before I'd gone to Somalia, I'd had those years in Tanzania, and you may remember me talking about that organization that I felt had abused the goodwill of those young people who'd gone out to work in those forests. And I felt I had a debt to pay, you know, that all that money that had been paid by those people, and they'd done it out of the goodness of their heart to help preserve those forests. But nothing would happen unless those results of all our expeditions where we collected animals and plants and catalogue what there was there, unless it was properly written up, nothing would happen. There'd be no conservation action. So I wanted to go and finish that work. And then someone contacted me and said that they'd found some money in from the Norwegian embassy in Dar es Salaam, and there was 3 months money for me to go out. And in the end, I chose to stretch that payment over 6 months to do the job properly, and I wrote everything up. And then another contact contacted me and said that he was a lecturer at the University of York, and there was some grants for a master's program, and I could apply, and I might get a grant. And I did, and I got a grant. So I went and did that for a year and really improved my research techniques. Although I didn't even have O-level biology, so I hadn't studied biology since I was 13. But I was the one that received the top marks in that class. I got a master's degree with a distinction. And some of the lecturers at the university wanted me to stay on and do a PhD because they said I had a really great skill as a researcher.
Hmm.
But I felt very deeply that God wanted me to go back as an aid worker. And it was a very difficult time because I also had a sort of premonition that something very bad would happen to me. Actually, I even thought I was going to die. And so there was this sort of urgency in that year I was at York of trying to wrap up all my affairs to finish the book I was writing on the forests of East Africa. And just forgot to mention that I'd been invited to join someone in editing a scientific textbook on those forests. So I wanted to get that done, did what I could. Then I contacted Médecins Sans Frontières and said I was available again to go out. And I said I'd be ready from the 31st of October. And I think it was the day before, I heard on the radio that a new war had broken out in Congo. And I remember sort of watching, you know, that crisis unfold, because all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it seemed, a war broke out in the east of Congo, where there were 1.2 million refugees in refugee camps who had come over from Rwanda and Burundi and lived in miserable conditions for a couple of years. And then these camps were attacked by the new rebel movement, so-called rebel movement. We later discovered it was, in fact, an organized invasion from the neighboring countries. But I remember watching on the TV being announced the United Nations had lost all contact with 1.2 million refugees. I mean, you know, that's really unimaginable.
Mm-hmm.
So these people just disappeared into the forest, and no one knew where they were. So this is early November 1996, and Médecins Sans Frontières called me and asked me and said, would I go out to Rwanda and Congo? And I said yes. And so my parents took me to Bristol Airport, and I flew to Amsterdam. And my mother subsequently said to me she thought she'd never see me again.
Mm.
So and then I arrived in Amsterdam. And that time, there was such a huge demand for flights to East Africa, whether to Dar es Salaam or Nairobi or Kampala, that, in fact, there were no tickets left because this huge emergency had erupted and so on, that it took 10 days before they got a flight for me. So I was stuck in Amsterdam for that time. Well, first I arrived in Kampala. When I arrived, the main airport of Kampala is called Entebbe. I arrived one night, and there was vast amounts of American military equipment there. And I thought, wow, there's something huge going on. That was my first sense immediately on arriving that something was wrong. And then I took a flight to Kigali and the capital of Rwanda. I was driven down to Gisenyi, which is on the border, worked there for a couple of days. Initially, I was just part of the Rwanda team, as it were. And there was a very small team in eastern Congo in a city called Goma. And then at some point, they needed a few extra people. And for one reason that I don't know why, I was one of those who was chosen to go, who went across. To get into Congo there, you go down the great African Rift Valley. So you descend down Gisenyi, and then you cross the border, go through Goma, and there's this volcanic plain down to Lake Kivu, where there's sort of this completely black volcanic rock and the remains of this refugee camp, where there'd been 700,000 people, would have been completely emptied, and just sort of stick shelters and tattered bits of rag and all that sort of thing. And there was a sort of a big dark volcano in the distance, and there was lightning, and there was dark cloud and driving rain, and I sensed God's anger. And these soldiers there as well, that strong feeling of God's anger of what was going on. We waited for those refugees to come out, and they never came out. They came out in small numbers, usually just fit young men and women in their 20s. And the local people were very, very scared, they thought, you know, because these people are here among us, the soldiers going to turn up and attack us and kill those people. It was sold to the world as an uprising, but it's commonly recognized now that this was an invasion from neighboring Rwanda, Burundi, and Uganda. But we weren't meant to know that, so it was a lot of efforts were made to cover that for us, and the so-called soldiers were meant to be rebels, and their objective was ostensibly to remove the president who was in power, and that was Marshal Mobutu, who was used to a colourful figure in a leopard skin hat, who was had a reputation being the great kleptocrat, the guy who ruled by thieving. So while that war was proceeding, they were trying to topple him, and eventually they did remove him from power. But there was a very dark other undercurrent that was going on. That was the wholesale slaughter of those refugees who'd been driven into that forest. And over the subsequent 5 to 6 months that I was there, those people were chased for 2,000 kilometres through the dense, inhospitable jungle. So it was very, very difficult those months, because not only was there the horror of what was going on, unseen, that we, I mean, in those 5 months, I didn't see a single corpse. And yet there were times when I'd be driving with, for instance, the head mechanic, and he'd say to me, you know that there are massacres going on in the villages around us. And then he'd say, over there behind the petrol station, that's where they're burying some of the corpses. And another time I was driving with another driver, and there'd be freshly turned earth on the sides of the road, stinking of rotting flesh. Mm. And he'd say, those are the tombs of the dead refugees. And he used the French word tombe, which is, tomb is a kind of a macabre word in English. Some of my colleagues were going out into some of the places where the refugees would turn up after there'd been an attack. The refugee camps would be disbanded, the people would flee, and then some people would emerge out of the forest. The next day when they came back, because these places were quite remote, they have to fly in, there'd be fuel drums on the runway, so they couldn't land. And the next day there'd be some other obstruction, and then when they did come back, there'd be nobody. Everybody had gone. Those people had come out. And then there was another moment where there were some camps south of Kisangani, which is one of the big towns on the Congo River, and there'd been 50,000 people in these camps, and they were in. And there were a couple of thousand who were in our hospital who were so weak and malnourished and had tropical wounds because they had received sores that hadn't been treated for months, and they were suppurating and so on. And they were really in too poor condition to even move. And then once again, there was a couple of days, the ferry across the Congo River broke down, and then there was some other incident, another incident. They couldn't get there for 3 days. And when they returned, it was completely empty, and there were bullet shells all over the ground. There were massive mounds of earth that stank of rotting flesh. But there was also this intense sense of threat that if any of us spoke out, you know, either we would die or our colleagues would die. And so there was this very, very strong sense of evil. I was then assigned to a duty in the city itself, in Goma. And then that evening, myself and the nurse, we came back early. Compared to everybody else, which was just two of us in the house. Then a young 30-year-old French priest turned up on his red motorbike, and he said that he'd been into the forest, and if you walked 3 hours through the forest, there were hundreds of corpses of these dead refugees. And you walked another few hours, there were hundreds more who were huddled in the trees, you know, frightened, waiting, not knowing whether to try and flee, knowing that the rebels, the so-called rebels who were in fact the Rwandan army, would kill them. And he invited us to go and join him, to go and get those people out. And you can imagine, you know, that's really very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking at that time, that's it, my life is over. You know, and actually feeling very sad, you know, I was 29. And there, you know, in a day or two, that was it. I would go into that forest and then something horrible would happen. And then on the other hand, you sort of think, well, you're there, you know, you're on the spot. So you've got to, you've got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I volunteered, and I'm eternally grateful that my head of mission, he recognized it was too dangerous. He recognized it was totally foolhardy for us to go. And that French priest in the end, he got the local scout troop to go, these young teenage Congolese boys, and they were caught in the forest, and some of them were tortured, and I was, you know, so that kind of confirmed that side of the story. And he was eventually also caught by what seems like the other side, and he only escaped because he was French. So really, right from the start, I knew something was up, both what I'd seen at Entebbe Airport mm-hmm. with this massive American military intervention mm-hmm. and the stories, these killings going mm-hmm. on in the forest.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any regrets at that point that you had gone back in?
I actually don't remember. I think that in those moments, you know, you're in, it's so dark that you're just fighting to get air mm-hmm. in that situation mm-hmm. of, but there was also a sense of hope. I mean, in the darkness, there was this bright light of this French priest going in and trying so to save those people.
Quite an inspiration.
Yeah,
to
very
you
much
then.
So. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a Catholic. He was a Catholic mm-hmm. Priest. Mm-hmm. And three times in the different aid situations where I've been, three times I've seen that actually, when the chips are down, the Christians who really stand by the people are the Catholics. And we can have lots of concerns about their theology and so on. Mm-hmm. But that is a church that has developed or attracted or inspired people to have a commitment to their faith mm-hmm. that we others really need to follow and understand.